a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3829 of the Survival Podcast. And as promised, we're going to go completely divergent from where we were yesterday. And I kind of feel like a whole new arrangement, I guess, or scheduling system of shows is in order, though it won't change much from what it's been, but it will make sure that I keep giving you what you expect from me. So for those that are new to the show and maybe catching me on YouTube instead of the podcast, on one of the podcast services like Spotify or Apple or what have you, stick around. Check this out. If you tuned in, especially after the fact, you're not catching live. It might be a little bit different than what you would expect. This is a podcast. I just do a video version of it. If you like watching and listening on YouTube, you know, hit subscribe, hit the like button, and hit the little bell so that you get alerts whenever I'm live on YouTube. Everybody else, just make sure you stay subscribed, and these will show up in your podcast app 4 times a week. Anyway, this show is a survival podcast. We do talk about preparedness, as you might expect from the title, but we talk about a wide variety of things. We're really a lifestyle design podcast, and we talk about things like homesteading and gardening and permaculture and growing our own food and preserving our own food, sort of like we're going to talk about today. Yesterday, we did a show on artificial intelligence. And I have been teaching entrepreneurship, business building, and lifestyle design since the very first day that I did this show, which was in June of 2008. So we're running on almost 2 decades at this point. 18 years this June will be our 18th year anniversary. So we kind of go all over the place. And then usually on Wednesdays, we have an interview. And that happens to be whatever that interviewer pitched, like we're in their subject matter. So it could be more of a business topic, or it could be an investing topic, or it could be a gardening topic, or it could be a prepared, you know, straight old school preparedness topic. That's kind of variable. And then on Thursdays, we do an expert council Q&A show for the week. We have a huge variety of experts that talk about all this stuff and more, people sending questions and they answer them. So that's kind of been 2 shows a week, or just me, 1 show in interview and 1 show expert panel. With the 2 shows for me, as much as I love to talk about entrepreneurship and technology and finance, I think this is what I'm going to kind of anchor on. 1 show a week will be in that realm, and 1 show a week is going to be a kind of the more homesteader, classic prepper realm, and then they blend with the other 2 shows. And I'm going to try to do that. I've discussed with my wife. You know, I'm writing a book right now. I just finished my 2nd book. That's with an editor. These are all on lifestyle design. They're called Laws of Life. And I'm working on a book right now called Me, Myself, and AI. And so that's on my mind. And if I don't lock myself into this kind of a thing, then I'm going to drift from what you've come to expect. So I'm going to work really hard on that. So what are we talking about today? Since I've said it is a classic kind of homesteader prepper thing, and it is understanding disease-resistant vegetable varieties. Now some science and technology is going to come into this. We're going to dispel some myths today that hybrid and GMO are the same thing. This is asinine, and it shouldn't be a thing anymore, and it still is. And I see it all the time on social media. Those are GMO hybrids. You're using words you don't understand. We're going to talk about why I hate modern GMOs. But I really don't, but I do because of how they're used. It'll make sense when we do. We're going to talk about how science isn't the enemy. We're going to talk about the best practices so that we don't need to rely on disease-resistant hybrids. But, well, what do you do in the interim? Joe starts a garden. He's never done it before. They tell Joe, just use compost. He goes down to Home Depot and buys compost in a bag. It's dog shit compost. It has a fine nutrient profile, but it has no biology in it. Joe's just trying to get started. Joe learns year after year after year. He keeps making his soil and his biological conditions better over time. But what's he supposed to do in that time? Get no production? If Joe identifies that he has a problem like rust on his beans or mosaic virus on his cucumbers, is he just supposed to sit there and take it and not get any beans or cucumbers? Or is there something he can do about it? Well, there is. And that is, he can identify the problem that he's seeing. I have this particular disease showing up, or I know it's common in my area because even though I haven't started, I'm just starting. I've talked to my neighbors who garden. They say, you know, every year, right about the time that my tomatoes start to produce, I get blight, and I think it's late blight. And so then they might go and choose something like an indigo rose or a better boy or a black plum tomato. We're going to talk about that today. And that doesn't mean that we shit can, you know, the idea of building great soil, about building up the BRICS readings in the sap of our plants or something like that. It just means that there are alternatives, and sometimes these alternatives will get you closer to the mark. All right. So that's what we're going to talk about today. But before we do, I want to talk to you about our sponsors of the day who help me bring this show to you Monday through Thursday, 4 days a week, because without them, I'd have to sell a lot of other stuff and I'd have to do something else. So they help pay the bills around here. So remember that when you're choosing who to do business with. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is the Wealthsteading Podcast with John Pugliano. He is an investment manager and financial podcaster. He is also one of us, one of us. He is a prepper. He's got the garden. He's got this really cool mobile office that's an ultralight RV that he travels all over with his ham radio and his satellite internet stuff. He's a reloader and a firearms enthusiast, but he's also a fantastic investment manager. You can be more than one thing. I know. It's crazy, right? He has about 40 years of investing experience. You want to check out his podcast called the Wealthsteading Podcast at wealthsteading.com, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden, where John will tell you what he's doing with his money, which means what he's doing with his clients' money, because he does the same things with both on a weekly basis, in a short, concise podcast that addresses some of the concerns you might have in the market at any given time. So check him out today, the Wealthsteading Podcast with John Pugliano. And I know what you're thinking. He's going to sell me some $300 a year news. No, he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do anything. You know, I never really thought about it. I never mentioned that before, but I never really thought about it before. If you're tuning in, relatively new listener, and you don't know who John is, you might be thinking, yeah, it's another like Motley Fool like type thing where they're trying to sell you expensive strategies. He just tells you what he's doing. Doesn't hide anything. And in doing that, he acquires more clients for his investment management, and that's it. He just gives this back as a service because, believe it or not, he's just that kind of guy. Now for something totally different, a very long-term sponsor of the show. KnifeKits.com was one of the first sponsors we had. I don't know if they were the very first. I'm pretty sure that was Safe Castle. But Knife Kits, we took on within the first couple months of bringing sponsors on, which would have put us in the winter of 2009. Yes, 2009. KnifeKits.com was a sponsor in the first quarter of that year. They're still here. That's loyalty. That's long-term. And that shows you that, one, they love doing business with you, and two, you love doing business with them, or they wouldn't stick around and pay me every month for God knows how many years that is. I can't do the math today. You figure it out. Anyway, KnifeKits.com is a great place to get knife kits. That's what they do, where you can build a knife no matter who you are. Starting from ground zero, you can get a kit. If you are much more advanced as a knife maker, you can get raw materials, all kinds of cool stuff. Mammoth tusk, buffalo bone, elk bone, buffalo horn. It's really cool, the stuff they have. Plus, they have stuff for making like holsters and sheaths from leather and from kydex. Lots of cool stuff. Check them out at KnifeKits.com. With that, let's get on into this. And what I want to start out with is not just like, here's a list of disease-resistant vegetable varieties that you can use. Number one is AI-generated videos can do that slop, right? We actually want to understand the situation and what we're dealing with here so that we can make better decisions for ourselves. If I just give you, like, I'm going to give you some examples today. I'm going to say, like, the biggest problems you have with beans are rust, bacterial brown spot, and halo blight. And here's what that looks like. And if you have that problem, here's varieties you can try. But that is very surface level. It is much better that you understand the whole situation, how to diagnose what you're looking at, and understand the disease that you're seeing. Then you can do research as to how to correct the problem at the biological and the soil layer, but you can also choose a more disease-resistant variety for the next time you plant that particular thing. And to me, that is empowering you versus being the source of all knowledge about what to plant. I don't want to be that. I want to be the guy that helps you figure out how to do what you want for yourself in all walks of life. So I want to start off with, as soon as you start talking about seeds and the seed sellers, right, the seed catalog companies, et cetera, and including a lot of people, they're not really in that business. They source their stuff and repackage it and sell it under a brand name. They're as much responsible for the confusion as the media is. And so I want to talk about what is the difference between a GMO and a hybrid and an heirloom and a wild type, and how does all four of those things play together? So let's start off with what a GMO is. And when you understand what it is, then everything else isn't a GMO. Genetically modified organisms, GMO, when we are talking about plants and sourcing seed that has GMO gene stacking in it, means that science did something unnatural to force a gene into the organism that would not naturally occur or be there. And so an example would be, there is a particular strain of cotton. I know you don't eat cotton, but there's a lot of shit with cottonseed meal and cottonseed oil in it. There's a particular strain of cotton that has a gene that comes from a fish, and it was inserted using a virus, a transmutative virus, because viruses transmit genetic material. So they literally infect at the genetic level the DNA for this cottonseed, and that injects the DNA from a fish. And I think you can understand how a fish that lives out in the ocean would never be able to exchange genetic material with a cotton plant that grows on land. That's an extreme example, but I'm using it to explain to you. And there's different ways that they do this genetic modification. They can use transmutagenic viruses. There's a thing called a gene gun. There's gene splicing. And new technologies being developed. But that's the important part, that you have two things, right? I have a cattle range cube. Ironically, it made me think of cotton. That's why I used the cotton example, made of mostly cotton seed meal. And I have a fishing weight. These two things are not the same. Right, they have a loose correlation. Both of them can be used for fishing. The range cube can be used for catfish chum, and the weight can be used to hold the line down to catch fish. But they don't go together. GMO is where we take a piece of this and stick it inside here. This is not natural. This is not right. And it can lead to negative consequences. But I actually don't hate it in of itself. We'll get to why I hate it in a moment. What is a hybrid? See, because of stupid marketing, right? Because of the desire to just get business no matter what and get business instead of promoting what you have, instead of trying to tear something down to make yourself look good, which is what so many people do, we have made in the minds of many people hybrid and GMO the same thing. They are not. A hybrid is simply a crossbreeding of two types. So if we had something let's just call it corn A and corn B, they were both open pollinated corns. They are heirloom corn varieties, Silver Queen and Kentucky Gentleman, right? And if you save the seed from those and you plant them, you get the same thing over and over and over again. That is a heirloom variety, and we'll talk about next. Well, when you save seed from them, what you want to do is you make sure you don't plant them where they're going to pollinate each other at the same time, because then they crossbreed. And then you get some form of a hybrid, okay? Most hybrid vegetables, they test cross-pollination, and then they intentionally cause it, and then the seed from that is a combination of A and B. This occurs naturally all the time in nature. Every heirloom that we have started out as a hybrid that then was rebred back to itself over and over again. Usually about 7 generations is what it takes. And so we take A and B, we put them together, we get an AB hybrid. All right. And then I want to get into a Mendelian explanation here of F1, F2, F3 type generations, but we just do that. So now we get a type AB. And everybody that comes out is an AB because everybody was a combination. Okay. We plant the seed from that. Some of them, a very small percentage, will look exactly like the parent plant, that first generation hybrid that we liked. Most of them, say 80, 90%, will have some features that are not what we're looking for. You save only the seed from the ones that turned out the way you wanted them to, that looked like the parent generation, that F1 hybrid generation, that's your F2, and then you plant those. A larger percentage of the next generation will retain the characteristics of the first cross. You save that, and you do it, and you keep doing this, okay, until you prove out the new variety.
And now you have a new heirloom, at least eventually. You have a new open pollinated variety. You have something that if it doesn't cross pollinate with something else and you plant it, you know what you're going to get. You've stabilized the genetic relationship. Okay. Hybrid becoming a new open pollinator. It's the same plant. It just has gone through selection. So a hybrid is no more a GMO than if you have a dog that is a German Shepherd and your neighbor has a dog that's Border Collie and one of them gets over or under the fence and they do what dogs do and they make babies. And you have Shepherd Collie dogs. They're not genetically modified organisms. That happened naturally. Dogs do what dogs do. And the girl was in heat at the right time. And the guy was like, I'm here, baby. And boom, you ended up with Shepherd Collies. Okay? And contrary to what some people believe, this will have no effect on the parent generation. Like people will say, well, I planted a squash. And the squash that came off of it was weird. It was a Franken squash. So it must have cross-pollinated. No, it's parent cross-pollinated. Like when you have a shepherd and a collie make a Shepherd Collie baby, if the mommy was the collie, she doesn't turn into a Shepherd Collie, and neither does the daddy. He stays a shepherd, she stays a collie. This is hybridization. Why do we do this? Because there's something called hybrid vigor. And you can see it in some extreme examples, like where science has managed to do things like cross a tiger and a lion and make a thing called a liger. It's a real thing. You can look it up if you don't believe me. And the liger is bigger than the tiger or the lion. It is huge. It is ginormous. But if we then take two ligers and put them together, I don't know in that particular combination if they're – sometimes when you do a hybrid, the offspring are sterile and they can't reproduce. Sometimes they can. That's like a mule type thing. So if they can reproduce, that vigor does not make it into the next generation unless you breed the hell out of it and find the one or and then you purify it like we talked about earlier. You stabilize that new thing. Got it? With selective harvest and selective saving and selective rebreeding. These are natural processes. And when the GMO companies say, hold on, before you get all mad at us, mankind has been creating genetically modified organisms when it comes to vegetables and fruits for 10,000 years. Bullshit. No, what mankind has done for 10,000 years is everything I just said. What GMO companies have done for the last 30 years is everything I started out with. Injecting genetic material into plant genetics that could not naturally occur and artificially controlling it. So those are your GMO hybrid. Your heirloom is simply, again, something you could save the seed and replant. We also call that open pollinated. Open pollinated is a much better term. I say heirloom because it's the word most people use. But that is like, you know, you have this thing that your mom handed you that was handed. But we have new heirlooms every season as some of this work is done to stabilize, right? And then you have what's called a wild type. This is exactly what it sounds like. I grow not this year, I'm not doing it, but occasionally I grow a wild type tomato called Matt's Wild Cherry. Usually something has somebody's name on it is because they bred it. But Matt, whoever the hell Matt is, just happens to be a guy that found this thing and like started using the seed and then it caught on and the name caught on. So it's a wild type tomato, very little tiny tomatoes about the size of a currant. And so much of what we have today, when you say, well, hybrids are bad, without hybridization, we wouldn't have it. That's what the GMO companies are trying to pretend with when they say we've been doing it for 10,000 years. Go find wild corn, wild type corn. You can't. You can't. Doesn't exist. The closest living relative we can find to modern corn is a plant called Seoente, which is, it's not, there's no way you could make a living eating it. This is not possible. Man by hand created what we think of as corn, which is really the right word is maize. A lot of times if you read old literature, right, the person that thinks they're smart will be like, this has to be wrong because it talks about corn. And it talks about corn in England. And it talks about that back in the 1500s. And there was no corn in England yet because they hadn't been brought back from the New World yet. Well, actually about the 1500s it had, but I don't care. It was the 1300s. The word corn as it was used in not only in English, the actual word corn, but words that would be taken to mean corn in European languages like German and Dutch, etc., referred to grain. Grain, right? So wheat could be considered a corn, the little grain on the top of the head, just to throw a little more at you today. Now, so I said I don't hate GMOs, but I do hate GMOs. That sounds like doublespeak. So what do I actually mean by that? What I mean by that is, it is not the process itself that bothers me. It's the reason for the process. So, for instance, there is some GMO work that occasionally gets done that's like, if you just did that, then maybe we would have something to talk about. The American chestnut blight is an example of a horrible thing that happened and a terrible human response to it. It actually mimics what the government did for COVID really well. So all of a sudden, all these chestnut trees in the United States started getting blight. So to save the chestnuts, we killed them all. The timber companies went in and cut every single chestnut they could find to the ground. And so we murdered all the plants. So if there was the genetics inside the chestnut to have a blight-resistant or blight-immune variety, we made sure we couldn't find it. I will leave that under they know not what they do. Okay, and not claim that anybody did on purpose. I will tell you, at the time, though, the timber company saw this as a way to get all the chestnut wood that they wanted as fast as they could with no regulation, because it was far enough along. We did have some regulation controlling how much timber was being cut. So it was nefarious, but I don't really think anybody was like, hey, what we're actually doing is making sure that we're going to eliminate the American chestnut from existence, right? And we're not going to find something that actually can resist this, because the odds that there was, you know, 100 million, probably well more than that, chestnut trees around, that none of them had immunity was pretty low. Well, this came from the Chinese chestnut. So the Chinese chestnut has genetics that make it immune to the blight, but it carries the blight, and that's what brought it into the country. Well, there's work being done to do GMO so that we can take just the genetics of the Chinese chestnut that make it immune to the chestnut blight and inject that into the American chestnut. And then eventually you stabilize that to where when you save chestnuts and plant them as seed, the next generation is immune to the blight too, right? And it is, for all intents and purposes, an American chestnut. Genetically, it's like 99.98% identical, but the leaf type and the leaf form and the bark and the height of the tree and the diet and everything else, if you looked at it and you didn't know what you're looking at, you just say that's just an American chestnut that somehow doesn't have blight. If that's what GMO is for, and that's what they always try to pretend that they're doing, it's golden rice so children can see and other bullshit stories. Not a single grain of that golden rice shit has ever been grown anywhere where children need to see better with more vitamin A. It's all PR. So if they were doing that with it, if they were doing things that so plants could grow in areas that they can't grow now, that would be different. But what are they actually doing with GMOs? Well, what they do with GMOs is, see, the company that GMOs the seed is the same company that makes the chemicals. Bayer, right, which is now Monsanto is part of Bayer. You got Conagra and what have you. So what they do is they say, we're going to make a corn that you can spray with an herbicide and it won't die, so that the weeds around it will die. We're going to make a corn that if a corn earworm eats it, the corn earworm dies, and we're going to feed it to you. We're going to make a soybean that we can spray with Roundup and it'll live. We call it Roundup Ready. We also make a Roundup, by the way. And this way the farmer can plant it and then spray it once it's up a few, you know, it's up half grown to knock all the weeds down and it just keeps growing. And now you're eating Roundup. I wash my food. You can't wash it off. It becomes like you can test urine from any municipality now and find Roundup glyphosate in human urine. It can, from people that eat only organic because of overspray and other problems I won't get into today. This is my issue. It's not genetic modification in of itself. It's why are you doing it? And what are the second, third, and fourth order effects of the widespread overuse of herbicides and pesticides? And it's a massive problem that has caused even plants grown on mountaintops, miles and miles and miles from any agricultural fields, through shit coming down in rain and what have you, to have these same issues with having toxins in them. So if it was only the people that ate the toxins, it would be, but no, it's not what it is. And none of it is done out of like this feigned belief that we're doing this for all humanity. It's all bullshit. Now there is something that may eventually replace GMOs, except the people doing it will only do it because they can do it faster and cheaper, and not because they care about you, but it's called advanced genetic selection. And advanced genetic selection is actually a very interesting sort of technology. When we're trying to make a new variety, we're trying to breed a new variety, we might bring multiple types together, but we might just glean from a field all the seed we can get and replant it and maybe expose it to drought conditions, but not enough to kill it, but normally enough to destroy yield. And any of the plants that yield highly are more drought resistant, if that makes sense, okay? And then we would save their seeds, and then we would repeat that process over and over again, and we breed a more drought resistant, let's say, soybean, or a more drought resistant cucumber, or whatever it is. Additionally, we could do that for something, a totally different thing, like we want something that can handle early frost that would normally kill a plant that got early frost. So maybe it can't handle a full freeze, but it can handle those days in the 30s. So if it's a grain crop like corn, and we can plant that a little bit earlier, then we can get our harvest in a little bit earlier, and that is beneficial because it's the less time it's there, the less time it has to hit the middle of summer and go into drought or other problems that can happen. Or a farmer can simply plant in phases and know this earliest one's going to be harvested first and stage their harvest. There's a lot of reasons you might do this. Okay. Advanced genetic selection allows us to look at the genetics of the plant seed and know what it's going to do before we wait for it to grow. So it's like planting, let's say, 10,000 plants in a field to get four. But what if we could look at the parent plants and already predict which plants were likely to produce that seed, plant only them, and then look at the seed and say, these are the ones that have it, and then begin building from there? That's advanced genetic selection. And that gets merged with GMO at times, and the people doing the GMO do that on purpose because they can say, look, what we're really doing is, and liars. But this is all, I want you to understand all of this as you're, you know, deciding on things like hybridization and breeding your own plants. Science isn't the enemy, though. Science is why our lives are awesome. Science is why some of you are listening to me live right now, sitting in my wife's office while mine's being remodeled. Science is why a guy like me was able to start a podcast in 2008 with a $35 recorder and a $15 headset, and spin up a website that was, it was okay. It wasn't as good as it is now, and start doing a talk show. Science is why, I can't remember what comedian it was, but there was a comedian that once said something like, everybody's complaining about everything, and I flew into this to do this show, and I realized I'm sitting in a chair in the sky, and you're complaining. Science is better living through chemistry, right? Science is why you live in a house with a box on the wall that you could change a number on it and you're comfortable instead of hot or cold. Science is why you get into this metal thing and you drive to places you want to go instead of walk there, right? Science is not bad, but science can be used to do some really bad shit. So just in all of this discussion, keep that concept in mind. Now, I want you to follow best practices, and if you need it specifically, I want you to use disease-resistant varieties in your garden. One does not replace or exclude the other. In other words, I can be working on building the best biology in my soil possible, and I should be, but I might still be having a problem. Like when I get a really, really wet spring, I get rust on my beans. What am I supposed to do? I mean, there's changes I can make to improve my drainage, but it's not really a soil moisture issue. It's moisture sitting on the plant for too long at a higher temperature than is typical. That's what one of the causes of that. So I can either just say it's a bad year for beans, or I can say I'm going to use a variety, since this is a common problem for me, that is resistant, not immune, but resistant to this particular disease. And I can work on improving my soil, and I can work on getting my Brix, which is a measurement of how much sugar is in the sap of your plant, is what you want to measure when you're doing this with vegetables. Because yes, if I get my Brix level up to 12, there's almost none of this happens anymore. If I get up to 14, which is kind of insanely high, like literal pests will fly over your garden, look down and go, nope, not my food. Not insect food anymore. All of this is possible, but we're all on a curve of time to get there. And we all have off years and bad years. And sometimes we know that bad year is going to come. Sometimes we know it's going to be a really wet year. Sometimes we know we're in a particular microclimate or area where certain climatic conditions always occur, and it is detrimental to one particular type of plant. So we can pick a hybrid variety for that need, even if everything else we do is self-saved heirloom vegetable seed. Maybe we pick a particular type of cucumber because we have a constant problem with mosaic virus or bacterial wilt, as an example. So we follow the best practices, and we choose the resistant varieties when that is mandated. And then you have to understand, again, that what I'm going to give you is a tiny representation, not an exhaustive list. And the real magic in this is learning to diagnose the problem. Am I looking at a disease? Am I looking at a nutrient deficiency? Or am I looking at a nutrient deficiency that has caused the disease? Okay? So we can end up with diseases that started out, yes, as nutrient deficiencies. And if that's the problem, some of these resistant varieties may not be as resistant as we would like. Okay? And you can have all the nutrients and all the biology, and there's still certain conditions that can develop that allow for disease and infection to infect your plants. So this is a very holistic way of looking at things. So what I want to talk about is just, I want to go through like what I consider to be the four most common things that people grow. And I don't mean the varieties themselves, but the macro, right? The four most common things that almost everybody plants in a garden: beans of some kind, cucumbers, tomatoes, and peppers. And they're also the ones that tend to have the most amount of disease problems, okay? So when we look at beans first, we have three primary things that infect beans. And these are common names, some of them anyway, that gardeners use. And I think that's better than trying to give you like the scientific name of the bacteria or virus, like right? But you've got rust, bacterial brown spot, and something called halo blight. Those are the three things that you will often see beans. Rust shows up as like small, rusty brown to reddish pustules on the leaves. This often causes yellowing then of the leaf, and then early leaf drop, like leaves will literally drop off the plant, like dry. They just look like the plant's old and gave up and quit. And it's kind of what happened, but it's like artificial aging. But again, it always starts with these little red pustules or the reddish brown pustules that look like when metal first starts to rust and it starts to get that spot rust before it's deep pit rust. That's what it looks like. That's why they call it that. Bacterial brown spot appears as small water-soaked spots that turn brown, and maybe you have like a yellow halo around them, which is similar to halo blight. So it's kind of important to figure out exactly what you're looking at. But you'll see that on the leaves and the pods. That's one of your indicators there. And then halo blight causes dark brown leaf spots, okay? So they're dark with wide, pale yellow halos. So it's not just a little ring around it. It's a wide halo around the spot. And the leaves can become ragged as the spots expand. So instead of turning brown and falling off like bacterial brown spot, the leaves kind of look like if you ever put a plant in the back of a pickup truck and drove faster than you should have and it stayed together, but it's had a better days, they kind of look like that with these brown spots mixed on them. Well, what do we do about that? What are the varieties that we can use here? Well, with rust, we can look to varieties like Jade to Bush Bean. Or if we want a pole bean, we can look to Kentucky Wonder. Those are two that are extremely resistant to rust. Okay. But if we're looking at bacterial brown spot as being the thing that pops up in our gardens most often, then we want to look to Cabot Bush or Kentucky Dreamer Bush. And honestly, there's not a lot of pole bean varieties that are very resistant to that. So you might even change the form of the plant that you're growing because of this. And then halo blight, Boone Bush and Frontier Bush are two varieties that are very resistant to that. Moving on, when we talk about cucumber, which again is a hugely popular, you know, everybody grows cucumbers, people make pickles, people just like cucumbers in general for salads and what have you, mosaic virus and bacterial wilt. And again, this is a place where they kind of have some similarities, but you can identify the difference and then you know what to select. So mosaic virus, you'll end up with this kind of mottled light and dark green patches on the leaves, along with the leaves have kind of a distortion. A lot of times they kind of almost get like a lumpiness to them, like something just isn't quite right, and they'll generally have stunted growth. Okay. And mosaic virus is caused by a pest, the cucumber beetle, which will actually spread the virus because it'll feed on your cucumber plants. It's a sucker. It's like a mosquito sucks your blood. It kind of does that. It like sticks its little beak thing into your cucumber plant and sucks the sap out. And it doesn't actually hurt the plant much at all. The plant can handle this. It's no big deal. Like if you went outside and just put some pinholes in a leaf, right? If the plant is otherwise healthy, it'll heal. It's fine. But if that needle, just like if you got stuck with an infected needle with some nasty virus on it, you can end up contracting the virus. That's how this works for the mosaic virus. And then bacterial wilt. This makes the plant just suddenly wilt. It looks like maybe you didn't water it or you severely overwatered it, right? Bacterial wilt is exactly what it is. And collapse even when the soil's moist, right? So it almost looks like you just stopped watering and the plant just shriveled up and wilted, except everything's wet. And a lot of times it'll like even just like you go to pick it up, it'll just fall apart. Or, you know, parts of it will just come off. That's usually with cucumbers, bacterial wilt. So the varieties we can look to if that's the issue. If mosaic virus is your primary issue, and for a lot of people it's going to be, is you can look at Market More is the name, and there's a couple different varieties, but the 76 and the 97 Market Mores are very resilient against mosaic virus. There's a variety called Chinese Snake and one called Dasher 2. Those are both also very resistant to mosaic virus, if that's your problem. If you have bacterial wilt, you also can look at some varieties. Again, Market More 76 is one of the most disease resistant overall because it's resistant to both of these that are the most common problems for cucumbers. And then Market More 80. Then you've got Salad Bush, Saladin, and Regal. And you don't have to write this down. The show notes for this episode have all these varieties, all this stuff in them. If you're watching the video, there's a link down there right in the video notes. You can expand those. Click on that link. You go over to my website, find all the notes for this, and you can get all this information there. If you're watching me live, you got to give me about 30 minutes after we finish the live to get it up for you on that side, right? But yeah, Market More 76 and 80 have that wilt resistance along with Salad Bush, Saladin, and Ringle. And you also with cucumbers can consider using spinosad, which is an antifungal that is natural and organic. You can use Prithium, which is basically it's a natural insecticide that kills the cucumber beetle, but you have to be careful with that because It's a contact killer, and if you get it on beneficials, it can kill them too. This is made from chrysanthemum is what I'm talking about. And you can use something called Kalion Clay, which is actually very effective against both mosaic virus and wilt. It helps prevent infection from bacterial wilt, and it helps keep the beetles from injecting shit into your cucumbers. Kalion Clay is one of the best organic methods of using a barrier against pests, and it can be used on fruit trees, in many other plants as well. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a clay. You mix it with water and you spray it. And after you spray it, it leaves like this gray coat that sunlight can still get through, to a degree. It's kind of like whitewashing a tree, but not as opaque. And so this can actually help plants that are getting too much sun as well, because it's kind of like putting, a suntan lotion on that still lets you tan, but it slows it down and you're less likely to burn. But the other thing it does is when any insect, especially sucking or chewing pest insects, tries to take a bite out of that, think about you have this big, beautiful Dagwood sandwich, right? It's delicious. It's got ham and turkey and roast beef, and bacon and cheese, and it's on this gorgeous toasted bread, whatever bread variety you like. You're ready to take a big bite out of it. And I throw a bunch of like hydrolated lime on it, or clay dust, or anything like chalk dust, and you take a bite out of it, and your mouth just, like, you can't enjoy it. You're not going to eat it. Like, it's ruined. That's what Kalion Clay does to these pest insects. It just gets in their mouth, and they just don't like it, and it makes it impossible for them to eat. So that's another thing you can add to that. Let's move on to tomatoes, and this is one that causes the absolute most problems for the most people, because blights and Fusarium wilt are very common, and because so many people grow them, and because they're so popular in the South. In the northern climates, you have less problem with your two blights, because they, you know, when it freezes in the winter, I see that question, and people should follow not your example, but you're lucky. That's a question we're going to answer. Okay. But follow this rule right here. Put the word question in all caps and maybe I'll see it. Anyway, coming back, because so many people grow tomatoes in the South, and because our ground doesn't really freeze, the blight is a soil-borne disease. It's a fungus. And because the ground doesn't, like up north in Pennsylvania, if you try to dig a hole in the middle of January, you're not going anywhere. The ground can be frozen a foot deep. So all of the blight fungus in that area that the ground actually freezes dies, or at least gets way knocked back. Well, in our climate down here, yeah, it'll freeze and whatever, but the ground doesn't freeze at all. And so it overwinters a lot more powerfully, but it can still show up in brand new soil. But it's mostly because the most popular thing people grow is a tomato. Just go to a garden center, or even a big box store where they sell plants this time of year, and like half the vegetables that they sell are tomatoes. So more people do it, so that spreads the disease, et cetera. So what do these different conditions look like? Tomato early blight starts as a dark brown spot with concentric rings on the oldest leaves. That's one of your keys there. It's your older leaves, followed by yellowing and leaf drop from the bottom up. So if you're looking at early blight, you're going to see it, right, starting at the bottom, because those are your oldest leaves, because as the plant grows, it's making new leaves. Yeah. And then it just starts to die and it like chases it upward. And there's some management we can do with this, is just pruning those leaves off. And that plant will usually just keep growing if it's an indeterminate tomato. And we can get plenty of harvest out of it before either that early blight catches up to it, or it just dies. But we can usually get some harvest out of it. Late blight causes greasy looking, dark lesions on leaves and stems that spread quickly and rot fruit in wet weather. It's a much more, even though it happens later, the late blight usually hits this way. Your tomatoes look wonderful. It's going to be the best year ever. The stalks are bigger around than your thumb. They're freaking 6 foot. They're just starting to fruit. Everything's wonderful, right? Everything's just wonderful, yeah? And you're happy. And then you go out and you see these greasy looking dark lesions on leaves and stems, and it starts to spread. And you're like, what is wrong? Why is it dying? If you add a tomato, and a tomato, we're not talking about blossom end rot. The tomato stuff just kind of rots. Not just from one end, like it just kind of all just bleh. This sucks when it happens. It sucks bad. It makes you like, well, I'm going to grow tomatillos. Screw a tomato. I mean, it just blows. Well, what can we do about, let me give you for wilt. It's going to cause yellowing and wilting on one side of the plant first until the whole thing collapses. So the leaves start to turn yellow and wilt, but it'll kind of be to one side and then it'll spread through the whole plant. What do we do about these three conditions? Like we want to improve our soil health. We want to improve our management practices. When we water tomatoes, we really don't want to wet the whole plant. We want to water the soil. Like, there's a lot of things we can do, right? We can prune off our lower branches of a tomato and open more airflow. But when all else fails, just choosing a resistant variety helps. Here's your early blight resistant varieties. Juliet, Matt's Wild Cherry, which is that wild type I mentioned, and Legend. These are three that really are good at beating early blight. But the one that's a death sentence is that late blight. And if late blight is what's getting you, Indigo Rose, Better Boy, and Black Plum. Try one of those or multiples of those. And that's always a good plan too. Like, I have this problem. Here's three great varieties. I'm going to grow all three of them and see which one does best. Yeah. And then maybe you standardize on that if it really holds up. Then for Sam Wilt, Park's Whopper, which is an heirloom that started out as a hybrid. It's been around so long, it's older than me. That's how old it is. Way older than me. I'm going to actually comment on that, Amy. That's a very good suggestion. And I'm going to say that we don't know exactly what's going on yet, but it does work. And I'll save that for Q&A. But I suggest that all the time to people I see buying tomatoes, and what she's talking about is aspirin. And I'll explain it later. But Indigo Rose, Better Boy, Black Plum for your late blight, for your Forsium Wilt, Park's Whopper, Super Sweet 100, which is very common in garden centers. So is the last one, Celebrity. Super Sweet 100 and Celebrity are incredibly disease resilient. But against Forsium Wilt, they are really not that resistant to late blight or early blight. So what will happen, this is why it's important to identify what your problem actually is, so you take the correct action, because Celebrity is flat out known as one of the most disease resistant hybrid tomato varieties known to man. Yeah, for Forsium Wilt. It has almost no resistance beyond what a typical tomato has to blight, either or. Okay. Now let's talk about peppers. Now, honestly, I have had such success growing peppers. I was surprised when I started getting emails from y'all saying you have problems with it. My best friend David calls me the pepper whisperer, and I don't feel that I do anything any differently other than and I do this with most of my plants, is I'm really big on spraying vegetables with compost extracts. Okay? Not teas. I'll do tea, but extract is my go-to because it's quick, fast, and easy. And I do it sometimes with bioreactor compost, but a lot of times it's just worm castings out of the worm farm. And it's as simple as I take like a bucket and I put a handful of worm castings in it. And I throw about a gallon to 2 gallons of water in with it, and I mix it up. And I mix it a couple times over 10 minutes, and I strain it into a sprayer, and I spray my plants with it, and I try to do that at least once a month. And I think that the peppers really, really like this. because my peppers are insane. And this is why when people say, it's just your soil. Okay, really? Because I'm sitting here looking at this cucumber with mosaic virus, and sitting right next to it is a jalapeno plant that, no shit, is 5 feet tall and has jalapeno peppers on it the size of a stubby, like high ring gauge cigar. And that plant is so green it almost hurts your eyes to look at it in the sun. So don't tell me I have a soil problem. I mean, maybe I have something missing that the cucumber or the tomato wants, but don't tell me my soil's not great, because that pepper plant doesn't look like that if the soil's just effed, right? So when I did some research, I found, though, and it made sense, bacterial leaf spot and tobacco mosaic virus are your two most common problems. And tobacco mosaic virus can be a tomato problem. It can be a tobacco problem, right? It could be an eggplant problem. I think a lot of people don't know this. Tomatoes and peppers are very closely related. So are potatoes. They're all nightshades. Yes, as in deadly nightshade. No, that doesn't mean they're going to kill you. There was actually, there's record in Thomas Jefferson's The Garden Book about a group of people who gathered around one day to watch a man eat tomatoes in a public square because they thought he was going to die because everybody thought the tomatoes were poisonous if you didn't cook them, because it was a nightshade. So they figured it's a nightshade, it's a red berry, if you eat it, you're going to die, but we cook it and we live, so that's okay. But if you eat it raw, and in fact, plenty of people had ate them raw, but no one knew it. And, you know, word of mouth spread things, you know, didn't have an internet where you could look shit up or anything. So the gruesome part is, like, this huge mob shows up to watch this guy eat a whole basket of tomatoes because he realizes nobody's going to believe me until they see me do it. So they didn't show up to learn about tomatoes. They showed up to watch the guy die, and he didn't die. And then it became evident, at least where Jefferson lived, that you could eat raw tomatoes, right? So they all are nightshades, and that's why they share some common diseases that they can have. So what do these two look like? For peppers, bacterial leaf spot will look like small, dark, water-soaked spots. Like somebody took a Sharpie, maybe a dark brown, not a black Sharpie, or it can be black, and made fairly large dots on your pepper leaves. And then they will eventually turn, like the leaves start to turn brown, and then the leaf falls off the plant. I've actually never seen this happen myself. I've seen pictures of it. And that's the other thing. If you really want to know what these, now that you know what you're looking for, go to Google Images, search for pepper with bacterial leaf spot. And, you know, when you find an image, don't just trust it. Click through, see the article, make sure it makes sense, and find a couple different pictures of what that looks like and compare it to what you're seeing. That's a simple, and then you can take appropriate corrective action at the soil level, at the maintenance level, and at the variety level to address this, right? Then tobacco mosaic virus, or TMV. And it's a good idea to learn the common abbreviations for these diseases. I'll cover that in just a second, why. TMV causes a mottled mosaic pattern of light and dark green on the leaves, often with puckering in distorted growth. Okay. And when you see that, it's most likely that you're, especially on a pepper, that you're looking at tobacco mosaic virus. Let me give you some varieties, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about this diagnostic component and figure out what to do. So when it comes to bacterial leaf spot with peppers, Admiral, Excursion 2, Red Bull, and Touchdown. These are all like bell pepper varieties that I'm giving you. And jalapenos to me, and most of your hot peppers, I've not seen much of that at all, even in other people's problems, right? Then the TMV, the tobacco mosaic virus, Big Bertha, California Wonder, Giant Marconi, Red Crest. In fact, most hybrid peppers have a degree of resistance to mosaic virus, tobacco mosaic virus. And so, sadly, there's tons of more problems than these, and proper diagnosis is your best weapon. So I want to talk about a few things. Like when I say that, make sure I'm giving you the right description here. It's easy to confuse all this. Something like tobacco mosaic virus causing a mottled mosaic pattern of light and dark green on the leaves. You know what else causes a very similar look? nutrient deficiency of calcium and or magnesium. So it's kind of important that you drill down into the problem and make sure what you're seeing is actually a disease and not a nutrient deficiency. And then understand a lot of times you have a disease that started out because you had a nutrient deficiency. For instance, during COVID, we did find out very quickly that people with low vitamin D levels, which is a human hormone, along with this dog, man. So along with selenium deficiencies, were more likely to develop severe cases of the illness, even if they were otherwise infected and would it be mild. So a lot of times you're having these worse problems either to do the atmospheric conditions or because of nutrient deficiencies. If you go to my website, thesurvivalpodcast.com/fertility, you'll find all the products and all the procedures I use in my fertility regime that make a lot of this go away, including some products that are nutrient foliar feeds. And the two combinations that you always want to have around in case you identify the characteristics of either being deficient, it will never hurt to add it, and it's very inexpensive. And since it is a mineral liquid compound, it doesn't go bad. There's no biology in the products that I recommend for this type of a thing, right? Because it's a mineral. So they are iron and zinc and magnesium and calcium. And you can have deficiencies in these, even if they're in your soil, especially the CalMag. But what's important to know is that plants and humans have something in common with these four minerals, four elements. And they are that both we and plants need both of them to use either in both pairings. In other words, if you are zinc deficient, you can't utilize iron. And if you're iron deficient, it's hard to utilize zinc. If you are magnesium deficient, it's hard to utilize calcium. And if you're calcium deficient, it's hard to utilize magnesium. Meaning when you see either deficiency, it could be a zinc deficiency or an iron deficiency. It pretty much looks the same because one causes the other. So it's both. And a CalMag deficiency, either or, causes both and it looks the same. And so by using a little bit of a liquid nutrient foliar feed, meaning we spread it on the leaves, right? If we do that, we bypass that problem because we're going, it's like injecting medicine with an IV straight into the patient. We want to do that in the evening when what's called the stigmata on the plants, these pores open, and we want to get that sprayed on the underside. It's not that you can't do it on the top. It's that it's more effective if we get it under the leaves. So we want a sprayer with like a little wand that we can get underneath and spray the underside of the leaves. And even if everything's perfect, if you live far enough south and your temperatures get hot enough, what will often happen is like your plants look a little bit miserable. They survive. They don't get any diseases. They make it all the way through. But they produce, like, let's say peppers are real common with this huge bunch of peppers. And then they stop flowering and they stop producing like July, August. And then the first cool nights of September kick in and you come out and like 2 days ago there wasn't a bud on. And then all of a sudden there's buds everywhere. And then a week later they're all open. And then you get this huge final harvest of peppers right at the end. You have this dearth in the middle in the south. Why? Because when your daytime temperatures average well over 100 degrees, the plant loses the capacity to absorb the magnesium and specifically the calcium from the soil. So the calcium deficiency then creates, you guessed it, a magnesium deficiency. The pepper can deal with this, but it says, I ain't making no fruit right now. Or it makes a few fruits and none of them are exceptional. But if we fix that deficiency, all of a sudden we're getting production at a time of year from a plant we didn't, and it takes a quarter's worth of liquid nutrient to do it. So I really encourage you to learn about these other aspects. What I'm trying to say is I gave you a patch today, right? Or a plug for your tire or a patch for your tire. You got a flat, you put a patch on it, it gets you by until you can put a new tire on or fix the repair properly. Yeah. Where the right fix is what the permaculture people and the regen ag people say. Get the biology right and pretty much almost everything will take care of itself. But this is your stopgap measure. And what's the big deal anyway? Why wouldn't you perhaps, if you find out that something like Jade Tube Bush, if you like aggro green beans, is a fantastically resistant variety to rust. You have rust as a problem known in your area, and you grow beans. And you think you've got all your stuff dialed in. There's no reason not to grow Jade 2 anyway. We'll have to buy new seed. What's a packet of seed cost? $2? You know, you're growing one plant with three beans. That's pretty expensive. If you're growing the whole packet of seed, I mean, the more beans than you know what to do with. And so when something goes wrong in a cycle, that variety is more resistant. What we're talking about is stacking the deck in favor of the producer. You're like, well, I want something like Jade 2, and I want it to be something that I can save seed from. You can do that. That's another thing I hope you glean from today. You can take a hybrid variety. You can plant a shitload of it. You can harvest a shitload of seed, set up one bed to grow nothing but it next season, replant all the seed you save. Selectively harvest. It might take seven seasons, but beans are a short-term crop. You can do two in one season. Easy. I've done three rotations of beans from seed harvested that year in a single season. And I've done it with things like Chinese noodle bean, which is resistant to all this shit, by the way. Okay. And I did it just because it was fun. I wasn't even trying to breed something. I'm just saying it can be done. So you can do that. The question you need to ask yourself is how important is it to you? Do you believe the world's going to end tomorrow and you need to have a seed bank? Then it's really important to you. Do you think that's a little bit over the top and you're not going to survive on beans anyway if that happens? And you can always store the heirloom varieties as a backup, like a battery? Then do that. You can adapt what I'm teaching today to your situation. But what I'm suggesting is don't have this bias against hybrids. Is hybrids bad? Hybrids evil? Just about everything in your garden, no matter how old the heirloom variety is, began as a hybrid. The only way it didn't begin as a hybrid is if it is a true wild type. And there's not much of that. Orich, Holzatle, I'm trying to think of some goosefoot varieties. Some people grow lamb's quarters like a vegetable, burdock. There's almost nothing that you go buy in a grocery store. Maybe jackfruit or something like, but as a vegetable, almost every vegetable or fruit that we grow like a vegetable, right? Because a cucumber, a tomato, and a pepper, those are all actually fruits, though we don't think of them that way. A vegetable, we're eating the leaf, right? But almost anything, when you go to the produce section, and I don't care if it's like the super uber duber hippie organic store of uber organic hippies, and it has hippies on the roof blessing the rain goddess, when you walk through that produce section, almost everything in there either is a hybrid or began as a hybrid, because that's what humans did. We looked at wild type things and we selectively harvested and regrew and saved seed, cross-pollinated, figured out how it all works, and we made all this wonderful food that we now have access to that never would exist in the wild. You know, if you go to where peppers are native, well, now you will find a lot of big pepper plants and stuff like that. But if you went before humans did their work, they were all small. Peppers are not even an annual. Peppers, do you know this? They're a perennial bush. They're a perennial short-lived shrub with a life expectancy of 5 to 15 years. Jack, you're full of shit. I ain't never had a pepper plant live that long. Well, grow it in a greenhouse or bring it inside and see what happens. It'll live for years. That's what it is. We grow it as an annual because it freezes here, right? But I've had some members of this audience tell me, I've got plants ever since you said that years ago, 5, 6, 7-year-old pepper plant in a pot. They put it outside, right? And then in the winter, they prune it way back and they bring it inside and it starts regrowing. And when you put it out in the spring, it just takes off. Because that's what it is. There's so much that we take for granted that we believe because it's just what everybody knows. That's just not true about gardening, vegetables, fruits, etc., and plant breeding. And it's a wonderful, this is just kind of dipping your toe in the water and understanding that when you have a specific problem, every year this is what happens, right? Every year this is what happens to my tomatoes? What happens to my cucumber? If you diagnose that problem, you can take the biological solution, the chemical solution, and the plant variety solution and stack them together and make it worth doing, because the number one reason people quit gardening is two. One, they put the garden somewhere where they don't take care of the weed problem, and the weeds make your life miserable, and it becomes too much work. And two is because I planted all this stuff, and the amount I got out of it, I could have just went and bought it and been 10 times ahead financially. That's not why we do this, right? Like, I grew up with grandparents. We grew a garden as part of our food budget. We hunted for our food budget, right? Like, it was literally a cost-saving thing. That's why we did it. I promise you, my grandma and grandpa, they did take pride in what they grew, but it wasn't like, oh, we ain't eating them cucumbers from the grocery store. They got poison on them. That was not the play. The play was, why would I buy something that grows right there in the bottom of my yard if I plant it? Because we were poor. And so the things that are being done today and the amount of money that's spent today chasing a false belief that was never true staggers the mind. And I would rather people use some of these techniques that are a little more conventional than deny themselves the ability to produce. And you can always keep moving toward more and more natural, biologically based systems. And I teach how to do that. But I also know that Rome was not built in a day, and a gardener is not built in a season. With that, let me give you the item of the day and tell you a little bit about how you can support us, and then we'll answer some questions for you. Item of the day today is a gardening implement, and I love this thing. I've been using it for years. I bought my first one in, I believe, 2020 or 2019 when I looked it up today. It is made in Turkey. It is a Turkish-made folding, harvesting, and pruning knife. These are used in Turkey for berry and grape vine pruning. They fold in half, kind of like a great big pocket knife. They're fairly large. For those on the video, there's a screenshot of a video I did with this in my hand to give you a size of it. What I love about it, one, it does fold up. Because it folds up, even though it's got a great big curved blade with very sharp serrations on it, you can put it in your pocket and not cut yourself like you would with a rice knife, which is what I used to use before I started using this thing. So the fact that it folds is great. It is fantastic for harvesting greens and things like that. It's also fantastic when you have like weeds or grasses growing up around your plants and you really can't pull them out because you're going to disturb the other plants. You grab a big clump, you pull it to the side, you put this thing right on the ground like a scythe, and you cut that to the ground. So you instead of removing the problem, you basically disadvantage it to the advantage of your plants. And there's tons of other stuff you can do with it. I brought this to you a while ago, like I said, and it constantly goes out of stock. It is brought to you, I'm going to bring up the Amazon page for it, by a company called Glittering Bazaar. I have looked hard. I have reverse image searched this. From what I can tell, there is one company in the United States that imports these. Again, they're made in Turkey, and I bet you if you go to Turkey to like a flea market or whatever they're, you know, bazaar or whatever it is over there, they probably sell these things for $4 or $5. They're probably made out of recycled steel from springs, truck springs or something. I don't know. But I know that the design is hundreds of years old. This is an ancient design. It's been around forever. We just don't make them in the United States. They are in stock and on sale at the same time for about $20. They're also kind of cool. They have this, unfinished handle thing going on here. And so they're kind of cool to stain and kind of make your own. And the blade is a carbon steel blade that takes something like Permablue for guns really easily. So they're kind of a cool thing you can customize and give as gifts to your like gardening friends and stuff like that too. So hopefully that gives you another item that you can add to your quiver of things for your garden. And remember, no matter what you buy, if you will start your online shopping at tspaz.com, where you find all my reviews, you will help us out no matter what you buy, and you'll learn about some really cool things there too as to ways to save money, like the Amazon Renewed store and what it really is. just as one example. You can also shop Vivor from there and find all the cool discount tools that Vivor makes and everything else. And you help us out when you do that. You also help us out. Do they lock open? Anarchy says it doesn't lock open, but it doesn't need to, right? Because the way you cut with it, you're pushing against the resistance. It'd be pretty hard to close one on your hand. But no, I guess that is a risk if you do something dumb with it. But no, they don't have a lock back in them or a liner lock or anything like that. I'm sure you could rig that up. I've been using one for like 6 years, 7 years. I have never had that problem. I just don't know how you would do it. Anyway, you can also help us out by becoming a member of what's called the Member Support Brigade. You get a bunch of great discounts. Hey, I just ordered some stuff from Acura Botanicals. My discount on that order was $48. My membership's $50. There's 70 plus other discount vendors that give you discounts of things you're probably buying anyway. So you keep your business in the fold of the community. You get a discount, you get your money back, and you support the show. That would be great, and I'd really appreciate it. All right, let's take some Q&A. There's quite a few, but I think most of them are super chats. So if you want to ask a question, let me find somebody that did it right. Like you see on the screen right now, if you're in the live, you see how it says question in all caps? Do that over the next couple minutes while I answer these other ones, and I will get to yours. Anybody that super chats me, super stickers, throws me a couple bucks, gas money, whatever, you always show up whether you ask a question or not. That's a way to guarantee that I'll see it. So Christy Gnome's dog, sent me a $1.99 super sticker, no question or comment. Thank you for that. And the same person sent me another $5 and just said, love the show, Jack. Hey, thank you, and love the handle that you chose there. That was a dumb thing she did. Not necessarily what had to be done with that dog, but writing it in a book to people that she knew wouldn't understand it is dumb. Ernie Ferguson says, is copper sulfate bad to use against fungal diseases? In and of itself, no. It takes large amounts to be toxic to humans, but it is a broad spectrum fungicide. And the problem is you're nuking the fungal biology in your system. And the single most useful biological, like macro classification in soil and on and in plants is fungus. Most fungus that are in our gardens are beneficial. So we're nuking things like mycorrhizal fungus. And we have found that there are various different organisms, bacteria and fungi both, that literally exist inside our plants that are beneficial. You yourself, not in gross weight, but in total numbers, you're more bacteria and fungus in your body than you are human cells. We have a symbiotic relationship. So it's not that the copper sulfate itself is inherently bad. It's that if we're using it to treat fungus, we're also nuking other fungus. Does that mean I would never use it or scold you? No. What it means is if there was a particular fungus and I could knock it back with a topical application, I would apply it only to the plants that have the issue. And I would get as little as possible on the soil, and I would only do it because I think I need to. Because you're pushing back the biology that you're trying to build. So is it bad? No. Does it have negative effects? Does it have any risks that come with it? And the answer is yes. Amy says aspirin for tomatoes. Let me explain. We're really not exactly sure. We think it's the salicylic acid, which is the base of what makes aspirin effective, that actually helps inoculate or somehow make the plant more resistant specifically to blight. And what I do to harness this effect, and it's been dramatically effective for me, when I'm making a tomato plant, I'm putting a tomato seed in a pot, and I'm going to put that in my seed starting system to later plant out. I put an aspirin tablet in the pot. Like after I plant the seed off to the side of where the seed went, make a little hole with my finger and I shove an aspirin tablet in there. And it's just occurring to me, I hope I don't have a lot of blight problems this year just from my soil being healthier because I didn't do that this year. But I'm going to totally do what I'm going to say next for you, the third thing I'm going to say. I'm going to start doing that. So when I put the tomatoes out, usually I dig the hole to put the tomato in, and I throw like three tablets in the bottom of the hole. And then I transplant the tomato set out and it grows. And then about once a month, I will crush up like five aspirin tablets to a 2 gallon watering can and mix them into the water. And I will water all my tomatoes with that. And that has knocked blight in the ass, right? I still get some, but it's early blight that comes on late, I guess. And so it has, like, you see it starting to happen, but by the time it does anything that means anything, it's going to freeze and die anyway. And I don't care anymore. And that has been one of the best things. And I can't believe, one, I forgot to tell you. Two, I'm fortunate that Amy mentioned. And three, I forgot to do it this year. Damn it. Sagewood Coastal. Question, I love to grow super hots here in Florida. I seem to have more trouble with them in particular. Any specific advice? I want to make hot sauce eventually or sell the peppers. Sage, I'm going to ask you to do something for me if you're still here, because I can't answer that. What do you mean by problems? Was it one of the viruses, like the tobacco mosaic virus? What was the problem that you had in particular? What's going on? Are you getting good growth, but you're not getting good fruit set? Like, is the plant looking like it's doing really good? And then, like, tell me what the actual problem is. And he also says his overwintered pepper plants are the best ones he has. So you're a long-term listener, right? So I guess you're having problems with, like, maybe scorpion or something like that. So tell me what the problem looks like, and I'll see what I can do to help you there. Let me go back and see if any more questions came in. Hunter, are those vaccines they are thinking about putting into vegetables considered GMOs? It'd be pretty much the only way you'd get it into the vegetable. Like when you see the shock graphic and it's like some evil scientist with a needle and he's like injecting a potato. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. It would be genetic modification that would convey that virus, or I should say that vaccine, which is really something that looks like the illness itself that triggers an immunoresponse. This is insanity. This is insanity, and it has the potential to cause massive human disease, harm, and death because you're activating immunoresponses in people with no real control of dosing. Say you put it into an apple. One guy eats two apples a year. Another guy eats two apples a day. Like, how real this really is, I'm not sure of. But I know it is a gross, flagrant human rights violation, and I'm not being extreme when I say there are people that maybe we should be testing what the holding capacity of a light lamp post is, and they would be at the top of that list. Okay? You take that however you want to take it, and we go from there. And I think that's it. I do not see any follow-up from the gentleman asking questions about the hot peppers. He says they just seem way more finicky to stay healthy, whether it's pests or disease. What you have to do, not just for me to help you, for you to help yourself, you have to diagnose the problem. You have to figure out what the actual problem is. Is it a pest? Is it a disease? Is it a nutrient deficiency? That said, you can do worse. You can do worse than following my fertility program. Loss of organic matter in the soil. At least use a CalMag foliar feed before you even get there, as you start to really warm up in your summers. Your summers are hot like mine. Use that. But if you knew what you were dealing with, it would be less of a generic spray and pray type of solution, because that's what this kind of is, what I'm giving you. It's like a machine gun, just point it over there and just empty the belt, right? Just wave it back and forth and up and down and just – area denial, right, is what you're doing. Like when a doctor goes, I don't know, it's bacterial, broad spectrum antibiotics. Well, what bacteria? I don't know. That's why I'm going broad spectrum. That's kind of how we're looking at that there. So my instinct might be that it's just getting hotter than those plants are comfortable with, especially if you just see they get finicky or whatever. If they come back around for you in the winter, like as you're going into your winter, but you aren't freezing yet, if they start to really kind of come back, it is very likely that you're dealing with a calcium deficiency. But I don't know that because I haven't been given enough information, and I don't think you have enough information. So what you want to do is document, and I don't mean like it has to be scientific level, but like make notes when you start to see problems and what the problems look like. Go feed that into GPT, right? And use the CRIT method. Here's my issue. Roll. You are an advanced organic gardener with specific knowledge of the Florida ecosystem in and around. Put the biggest town near you here, right? You are to interview me, but this is what I'm already seeing. Your task is to provide me corrective action. I'm putting myself out of business with an AI bot, right? But no, that is one approach you could take and get some interesting information. But it's going to say the same thing. Well, what does it look like? What do you mean? With AI, though, this year, this would be an interesting, I've never done this. As the problem begins, take pictures and upload them to that chat. And as the problem increases, continue so it has more information. Maybe give it, like, it, a lot of times AI has a hard time going back in time. But you say, go look at the end, it'll say, oh, that image is, and it doesn't know because it didn't relook at it. Right? Re-upload, like, here's progression, week 4, week 6, week 8, and week 10. It's probably going to be able to figure it out for you and then help you plan corrective action. But if you bring me more information, I can do that for you too. But my goal with this show is to make people not need me. Like, I'm not the kind of content creator that always wants you coming back because you need me. I want you to come back because you're happy with what I already gave you and you want more. Right. That's what I've tried to do for almost 20 years now. Anyway, guys, I enjoyed doing today's show. I like having kind of the more light gardening topics and the heavier tech topics and the economic topics. And we'll always squeeze some news stuff in at least once a month or here or there. We'll have a Newsday Tuesday or something. But, you know, what are we going to talk about right now? The lunacy that's going on in Iran. And both sides are lunatics politically in the United States about it. You know, we're losing, Iran's destroying us or whatever. And then, you know, everything's perfect and we already won, but we're still spending billions of dollars a day to drop bombs. Like, I can only do so much with that. But what I can do is help you live a better life, whether times get tougher, even if they don't. That's the promise we've made and we've tried to keep now running 18 years. Amy threw me another super chat. 20 bones, man. $20. She said gas money again. Well-timed episode. Well, thank you. With, you know, $20 in gas money, not so long ago, I could go pretty far. Today I can take a couple trips to Home Depot and back or something, right? But thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. Thanks to everybody that tuned in today. Anyway, as I was saying, I cannot remember the guest that we have tomorrow, but we have a great guest tomorrow, and we'll have an interview show tomorrow, expert counsel show Thursday, and we'll be back at it again the following week. As always, if this is the first time you tuned in, hey, please consider subscribing and becoming a regular member of our community. Check out our social media. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on Get Social. You'll see all the ways to connect there. Above all, one of the best things you can do for yourself is stay in touch with us. Get on our Telegram channel. You'll get a few texts a day. It'll be like, hey, we just put out our item of the day. Hey, the episode is going to be live at. And hey, the episode's published. That's all that it is. Or you get on the Telegram group and connect with other community members. Take care, guys. Thank you very much. Sorry for the little technical flop there at the end.
They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month. Never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.